This is good. This is the object of your study. Actually, we can offer a lot of things to the three jewels. We can offer a lot of things. But the real offering is the practice of Dharma. The practice of Dharma comes from the study of Dharma, or study meaning listening, contemplation, reading, memorizing, debating, or discussing. So that's a very, very good offering to the three jewels. Much worth much more than money, worth much more than physical kinds of offerings, because this type of offerings actually lead to transformation. And transformation is the ultimate offering we can offer. That's why there's an offering called an offering of suchness, or the real clear clarity of the mind that can only arrive from what we're doing now. So this is a very good offering. Therefore, I always take this, I look at it later on, and I make an offering to the three jewels. And so this last month, you're studying the book, you actually read it, you actually take the time for it, then you take this class seriously. When you take this class seriously, then serious understanding will arise. When you take this class not seriously, serious understanding cannot arise. Why did we join KH? Why did we come to KH? Why do we go see Lama? Why do we come to the center? Why do we get close to the center, or listen? Why do we make the effort to learn? To absolute, to learn. There's no other reason we come here. To learn for who? For ourselves. In Buddhism, we always talk about all sentient beings. We talk about other sentient beings. We talk about mother sentient beings. We talk about suffering sentient beings. We talk about ma sentient tamji. All the time we talk about other mother sentient beings. But we have to take care of ourselves first and learn ourselves first before we can take care of any other sentient being. So what's the best way to take care of any sentient being or ourselves is by learning. How did we solve any problems in this life? Any problems that we have solved in this life, any problems at all, any difficulties we have overcome, mental, physical, has been through learning. Only by learning. Only through learning and from learning. From learning, we're able to solve our problems. Therefore, if we don't learn and we don't apply to learning, how will we solve any bigger problems? How will we solve? So therefore, this class is extremely important. It's for staff, Dharma staff. It's for Dharma volunteers who work on a regular basis. It's for people in different positions in the organization. It's to give it more faster learning. So we have to take this class very seriously, especially people who are in positions that can guide other people, such as the outlet people, such as the center people, such as the committee people. It's very important because you're the people who will bring Dharma to others. Remember my goal. My goal is not to reincarnate back and take over. That happens. That doesn't happen, doesn't really matter to me. My goal is what? Is that the Dharma that belongs to humankind spreads all over. And it goes into everybody's culture. And everybody's culture absorbs the holy Dharma and puts that as part of their rich, unique culture. And to be who they are and what they are, but to have Dharma as part of it. So in order for that enrichment to happen, we all need to learn the Dharma. So what's my point? In the future, I'm not aiming toward Tibetan teachers, Tibetan lamas and Tibetan gurus. I'm aiming for Malaysian lamas, Malaysian rinpoches, Malaysian teachers, Australian ones, English ones, French ones, European ones, Italian ones, American ones, Japanese ones, Chinese ones. That's what I'm aiming for. Why am I aiming for that? That's what happened in India. All the great Indian masters who can reincarnate in Tibet, in China, Thailand, wherever, all these countries practicing Dharma. And all these great students and disciples also reincarnated there. And some of you here are probably reincarnations of those great teachers from the past, most likely. Great students from the past, definitely. You're not here by accident. So my point is, I'm not interested in Tibetans coming and doing this and this and this and this, or Tibetan culture becoming big. I'm not against Tibetan culture, but you're not Tibetans. So my point is, by learning, when we learn, when we understand, we can dress how we want, look how we want, eat what we want, and be how we are, but give the Dharma according to other people according to their culture and what they know. So learning is very important. So this class is extremely important to develop local teachers, non-Tibetan teachers, not just local, non-Tibetan teachers in the future. You know, in the holy Christian faith, they go for Bible studies for 2 to 3 years, sometimes 5, and they're already out there giving teachings to people. In Tibetan Buddhism, there's a rigorous course of study that takes 15 to 20 years plus 7 years of oral and written examination in front of the highest authorities within the Gelugpa School of Buddhism. And that happens in Ganden Sera Drepung before you can get your degree. So I think most of us would not be able to engage in that. That would take quite a long time. And for some of us, it's a little too dry. It's not beneficial. It is very beneficial. But my point is, we should have an accelerated course. This is one of them, where we can actually start teaching and sharing and helping other people. Just talking about good things, just talking about good mind, just talking about kind heart and world peace is very nice, but we have to actually offer people the method. We have to offer. How do we offer the method? We have to know the method. If we know the method, we can offer other people the method. If you're not interested in taking care of all sentient beings, I am sure you are interested in taking care of yourself and the people that you love. The people that you love. So the people that you love and people around you and people that you care about, if you see something happen to them or they're suffering or they have difficulties or mental trauma, wouldn't you like to offer a method than just sweet words? And in the case of this lady, this wonderful Dakini lady in here named Christine, in the case of when her husband died, she mentioned if she only had known Sokya Rinpoche before he had died, she could have been able to offer much more to him than just comfort, physical comfort. We will come across that situation. We will come across loved ones. Every single person in this room will die. And some of us in this room know each other very well. And some of us in the future, when we die, will be with each other. When I die, some of you are going to be with me. When you die, I'm going to be with some of you. But what can I do for you at that time? What can you do for me at that time? You're going to be with me. Some of you are going to be with me when I'm dying or die in the process. And I'm going to be with you, with some of you in this room when you're dying. What can I do for you? I'm not a Buddha. Even a Buddha couldn't do anything for you. Jesus and Buddha and Muhammad, all of them show up in one room. They hold your hands. They can't do anything for you. You got to do it for yourself. So don't wait till that moment comes, that moment of truth. Don't make commitments your priority. Don't make making money and don't make fun and games and running here and entertainment and depressions and ugliness and revenge and explanations and being right and wrong your priority. That shouldn't be your priority. Why? When that time of truth comes, doesn't matter. I'll be holding some of your hands. I'm scared for you and for me. I'm scared for me when you're holding my hand. But even when you're going through the process of death, there comes a point where they're holding your hand, you can't even feel them anymore. Sheva mevachagras means you can't even feel their hands anymore. That's why you see people when they're dying, they say, are you still here? I can't feel you. Then coldness comes. Then they start seeing things. It's going to happen to all of us. All of us. There's no way to avoid it. So what am I going to do when you're dying? Hold your hand? What are you going to do to me when I'm dying? Hold my hand? Doesn't do much. It's better than nothing, but it doesn't do much. So my point is, we can do something right now. We can do something right now. Prostrations, water offerings, chanting mantras, all that is beautiful. Helping, charity, all that is wonderful. But that doesn't really, really help us. It doesn't really ultimately help another person. It doesn't really ultimately help. So when we study and when we learn, gradually, step by step by step, we will learn what to do. Think of every person that you love right now. Think of people that you care about. I mean it right now. Think that they're going to be a witness to your death or vice versa. You're going to be a witness to their death. What can you do for them? What can they do for you? I'm not trying to be morbid, but in Buddhism, when we use reality as part of the meditation and path, we become very happy. By meditating and thinking about and realizing and bringing up death, you live well. You live better. Why is that? Because when you bring the reality of death in the forefront, everything that doesn't matter goes away. People that we hate, that we haven't spoken to, example, in 10 years, 5 years, 2 years, if we find out we're going to die tomorrow, we'll make peace. We will make peace. Whether they want to make peace with us or not, it doesn't really matter. We need to make peace. It's about us, because we're dying. So right now, we're learning this. We're learning this. This is very precious. To me, this is an offering. So for you that have studied, that have read the book seriously, I take the time to go through this. I don't just pick any ordinary book. I have a huge library. I take the time to go through this because I care. I'm in Malaysia because I care. I take the time to go through these books and read it and go through a few to pick out something for the group. From different traditions, from different backgrounds, from all sources. All sources. So that I would hope that I can offer this to all of you and you guys would take the time to care about yourself and others and love each other. Love yourselves and to study it. And then when you come, when you answer questions, the question is not about right and wrong. It's not about, oh, you get a mark. No, there is no mark in the ultimate truth of reality when death comes. No, no marks. So therefore, when we have this class, when we study, it is really important. I promise you, after 1 month, 2 months, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, you will see your mind transform. When I say your mind transform, doesn't mean you're good or bad. It means you become better. It will definitely happen. It happened to me. I'm telling you confidently because it happened to me. And I'm tough. I'm stubborn. I'm really tough. I'm really stubborn. So it happened to me. It will happen to you. I don't think anybody in this room is as tough and stubborn as me. Close to it. Tough meaning what? Must be this way. Narrow and stubborn. I'm very stubborn. I couldn't have gone through my horrible life as a child if I wasn't stubborn. Stubborn is neither positive nor negative, is a quality I have. So I don't think anybody here is more stubborn than me. And let me tell you, these things have helped me tremendously. So we're not here to take refuge in the Guru. We're not here to take refuge in the Buddha. We're not here to take refuge in the Sangha. We're not here to take refuge in anything. We're here to listen to the Dharma and to have and to apply that to our lives. And from the change that happens, that is the refuge. The change that occurs from applying the Dharma. So those of you who have applied your studies, put your time into this. You really care about others and yourself. You really care. That's why you study. What other reason do we study? Even when we go for university courses and classes, what's the reason we go and study? To better the people around us and to better ourselves. It's the same thing. So this is to better ourselves. And therefore, when you take your time to study and listen and learn and come here and do this, it shows your great compassion. It shows your great love for others. It shows that you want to learn a method to help others. That's what it's about. So therefore, all this effort for the last 1 month that you've studied, the effort of coming, the effort of answering questions, the effort of sitting, the effort of concentrating and listening at this time, what do I do with all that? Tenrinchi can't do anything, but Tenrinchi can offer it up to the three jewels. So all this effort is transformed into the eight auspicious signs. Those eight auspicious signs appeared when our Lord Buddha gave his first teaching in Varanasi, Sarnath. And the demigods and gods were so happy to hear that the teachings were going on. Rainbows appeared, celestial music and flowers, and beautiful singing was heard. But along with that, they manifested the eight auspicious signs, meaning temporal, immediate happiness, and ultimate happiness. So each of the eight auspicious signs has something to do with a path and achievement in Buddha's mind, and it represents temporal happiness. So therefore, the eight auspicious signs immediately appeared. And therefore, those upon the tradition of those gods that made those offerings to the Buddha during the first teaching, we had the eight auspicious signs adorning many, many items, many religious items. So therefore, these are transformed into the eight auspicious signs. They dissolve into emptiness, from the emptiness of clear light, clear mind. They appeared as eight auspicious signs. So those of you who have made tremendous effort, the eight auspicious signs will be very complete. For those of you who have not made much effort, the eight auspicious signs will be a little not shiny. For some of you who didn't answer all the questions, there will be one or two auspicious signs missing. But better a few than none, right? We offer this to the Buddha. Take this seriously. Take this class seriously. Take it seriously. Why? Take yourself seriously. Take your spiritual practice seriously. You deserve it. You deserve it. And the people you want to help and the people you love deserve it. And by making this offering of learning, study, contemplation, by making this offering, the merit that comes back from the three jewels is that in the future, when we study and when we learn, no obstacles, the mind is very clear, and we can absorb very fast, so we can apply it better. That's the whole reason the offering up learning to the three jewels. Okay, good. All right, now. I like what Rod Lee had mentioned on page 46 and 47. I like that very much. I had known that for a long time, but I wasn't able to really verbalize it. I like it. My teacher represents the pinnacle of Buddhist practice for me, and he displays the qualities that I would like to have. Purity, wisdom, compassion, clarity. The lineage in Tibetan Buddhism is particularly special because it means that my teacher had a wonderful teacher who had a wonderful teacher, and so on. Each teacher is answerable to a teacher. This keeps the lineage pure and clear, and not so many misunderstandings or abuse of the teachings arise. In some other disciplines, you will find new age gurus, so to speak, popping up and proclaiming themselves as gurus. I'm not denouncing them or patting them on the back, but sometimes you will find that some of their teachings are not in the best interest of their students. When that happens, I have to ask, what are they doing it for? Maybe for wealth, power, or fame. This is what I stressed with some of you before. Whether we accept the person as our guru, whether we think of a person as our guru, or whether we don't think of a person as our guru, for many of us, it doesn't really matter. But what the person is speaking and talking about must have a lineage. So this doesn't just come from my training from Holy Ganden Monastery. You can see this in other lineages and other trainings also. And this one's from a wonderful, I assume this gentleman is an Australian gentleman. I assume, Mr. Rod Lee. So therefore, what I'm trying to say is, he's an advanced student, and he's been asked for by Acharya Geshe London to teach in the centers. So therefore, he himself also mentions that. When we want to teach the Dharma, when we want to share the Dharma, or we want to open our mouth about any spiritual practice, we simply cannot make it up from the goodness of our heart. Even if our heart is very good, we can't just simply make it up. We can't also have visions, and we can't also talk about visions, and we can't also use magic and theory and gods and Buddhas and deities and angels to appear to us to speak to others either. Why? It may or may not be valid for many reasons. I've talked about that in the past. And on top of that, if we want to convince people of powerful intellectual background, it's very important to have a lineage. If we have a lineage, the fear of abuse, wrong teachings, or twisted teachings, or misunderstood teachings. Some people don't go and teach things to people that are wrong on purpose. They have a good heart, but they don't know what else to say or do for someone. So when we have a lineage, when we follow a lineage, when we follow a correct lineage, meaning a lama who has a lama, she or he has a lineage, then it's much more profound. That's why when I recommend Dharma books to people, I recommend a few authors. You guys all know me very well. I recommend a few authors. I'll tell you why. Because I like them? No. Some of them I've never even met. I don't know. I've never received any teachings from them. But when I read them, they state a source. And the source is not simply pulled out of the air. That source has a source. As the great glorious Khyabjisarumji said many years ago, we cannot give a teaching without stating the lineage or the source or where it comes from, even if we're a highly enlightened being. Why? It doesn't help unenlightened beings like us. It doesn't help. So therefore, having a lineage, having studied with a teacher, having a good samaya with a teacher, and studying for the right reasons, and knowing where it comes from, we ourselves have confidence of what we're practicing. Why is that? Why do we ourselves have confidence? We don't want to spend our precious time and our precious energy and the little bit of time we have on something that we are not sure. I don't. So I want to practice and study something that I am sure of. Things I'm not sure of, I will not criticize because I don't have the time to check everything or everyone. Just because I didn't check doesn't mean they're not valid. I'm talking about for myself or for ourselves when we choose a path. When we choose a path, we must make sure it has a lineage. Lineage meaning what? The teacher is answerable to his teacher, to her teacher, to their teacher, to their teacher, to their teacher. And these teachings must stem directly back to Lord Buddha, directly or indirectly. Simply to be a guru or proclaim to be a guru or to talk or teach or not even proclaim to be a guru but just teach from the goodness of your heart or explain things that have no lineage from someone's mind, from someone's heart, from someone's visions can or cannot be valid, but there's always some element of doubt. And those things cannot take off very big. So therefore, especially within the Tibetan tradition, lineage is extremely important. Therefore, when we make prayers to the Lama and the lineage Lama. The lineage Lama making prayers is recognizing authenticity. Recognizing authenticity. That is very important. And even when you go to school, when you go to college, when you go to university, you want to know what the professor is teaching you from. You need to know where he learned this from. Who was his teacher? Where did he go to school? What's his degree? Where did the source come from? You also check that in daily life. Even what food you eat, most of us will read the labels. Although I've eaten and then checked the labels sometimes, too late. But anyway, most of the time I read it first. So if for food and for our normal education or for products, we will check where it comes from, the source. For Dharma, it's very important. That's why I always mention, don't be taken away by the teacher. Don't be taken away by the Lama or the deity or even Lord Buddha with respect. But you must be taken by the teachings. The teachings must apply and the teachings must be valid and have a source. They cannot simply be made up, said. And I'm not accusing anyone here or out there in the web world of making up for bad reasons. But they must have a lineage. They must have a source. If there's a source, the fear of wasting our time on something that's very precious, our mind, is gone. And also, when we give teachings, when we give practices, there will definitely be results. Definitely. Even someone as renowned and erudite and accomplished and achieved, such as His Holiness the Dalai Lama, currently, you guys know him very well. Or His Holiness Kepchen Sonrimchi, which I received many teachings from in the past, when they give teachings, even these great beings give a source. Give a source. And I've even seen videos of the great Reverend Mother Cheng Yang of Taiwan. When she gives Mahayana discourses, I've seen, she refers to a text. I am sure she's a master of Dharma. I am sure she's a master of Dharma. I have no doubt. I cannot check her attainments, but by her work, I can say her attainments must be pretty high. But, even someone of her caliber, if you watch her documentaries, when she gives discourses or talks, she refers to a Dharma text, as His Holiness. Even the great Mother Teresa, when she gave teachings and talks to her sisters, her disciples, I saw in her videos, I have many of her videos, she also always refers back to the scriptures, to the original scriptures, to the holy scriptures that Christianity is based upon. I saw. So great beings like that refer to the scriptures. Definitely, definitely, people like me and anybody else who wishes to share other things must have a lineage, must have a source. And that's why in our center, we have a very pure lineage. We are not the only lineage that's pure, but we have a pure lineage which stems from Ganden Monastery. And that stems directly from Lama Tsongkhapa. Lama Tsongkhapa is not the only pure lineage holder. Definitely not. Definitely not. But we can be sure he's one of them. So therefore, what we learn and what we study and what we investigate, we have some confidence. So therefore, simply taking things out of the air, if you know, there are high lamas. Really, there are high lamas, not just of Tibet, of all religions. Lama means a teacher who can commune with divine beings, who can talk with divine beings. But the age for them to say, I communicated with a divine being or had lunch with a divine being, and therefore I'm giving you this information, is over. That age to say that I commune with a divine being and I'm giving you this source as them, that age is over. That's why you never hear people like His Holiness even mention he had this dream or that dream. He'll very roughly just say it and get it over with. Why? That age for people to follow that is over. There's a few dark, backward, village people still holding spears like me who may be taken away by that a little bit. But most of us, I don't think so. We have to have a source. And I like that. When I read that, it was very nice. And therefore, the teacher doesn't abuse his power. The teacher doesn't abuse his respect that he gets. And the offerings and the people's adulation. And the people are not abused. Very important. Very, very important. So to follow a lineage, to follow a source, I cannot overemphasize. We have to have a lineage and a source. We have to state it. All right? So for anybody who's valid and they're teaching anything valid, you see, let me give you another, I'll give you something to think about. No teacher now could teach something that has not been taught by Buddha already. No teacher can teach something that has not been taught by Buddha. Impossible. So therefore, they're just repeating what Lord Buddha has taught 2,500 years ago. If it's for enlightenment, it's for secular power, I have no idea. But if it's for enlightenment, no teacher can teach something new that the Buddha hasn't taught. That would mean that someone else is a Buddha, or they're better than the Buddha, or the Buddha was wrong. That cannot be possible. So therefore, whatever we teach must stem from Lord Buddha. Therefore, we wouldn't have any problems quoting where it's from, would we? Some of us went for the teachings of Gelug Rinpoche. I went recently, just a few weeks ago, when His Eminence was here. And you saw His Eminence. He gives an appearance of, he's a little bit calm and relaxed, and if I may say with respect, slow. He gives that appearance when he gives a teaching, no way. When he quotes from the scriptures, no way. Everything he said, he kept quoting. Everything he said, he quoted. I heard in Tibetan, and then he'd repeat in English. Everything. Even great scholars like that quote. So therefore, that's very important. You think about that's so dry. It's not dry. We don't actually have to quote to everybody everything we say, but we can interpret that meaning to something more easier and simpler for today's people. But even if we interpret or we explain, it must come from the original source. So I'm a very big stickler for lineage. Whatever lineage you are, I have no labels for lineage, but I'm a very big stickler for that. Why? So no one gets abused. No one. No one gets taken for a ride. No one. And when I say taken for a ride, it doesn't also mean negatively. Sometimes we feel we're doing a good thing and we're helping people, but we may not be. So that's very, very important to me. That's why I encourage people to stick to their lineage, stick to their practice, stick to their yidam, stick to their lama, stick to their whatever they're doing. And if I have people, and I often do have people of other lineage and other lamas come to me for Dharma talks, I will definitely give such a Dharma talk to them that makes their lineage, their bond, and their relationship stronger and better. Why is that? What do we want to ultimately do for people? Give them a method for attainments? Or it's a bias, sectarian kind of issue where it has to be my way or no way? Having that thought and teaching the Dharma, then it's not Dharma. Having that thought, it has to be my way, my lineage only, my practice only. Thinking that way and then teaching the Dharma or listening to the Dharma, then it's not Dharma. For those who listen to the Dharma and say, oh, that's bad, that's not good, only my lineage, only my Lama, my whatever, my practice is good, and they very narrowly follow their practice and they criticize others or mentally criticize, then it's not Dharma already. How can it be? How can we cut this finger, cut this finger, cut this finger, and only want this finger, or cut this finger and only want this finger? We need all five. Doesn't make sense. So therefore, with that type of motivation is also wrong. And with the motivation of a teacher to teach in deference or against other religions, or to people to listen to the teachings against other religions, also that's not spiritual. That cannot be spiritual. It cannot be Dharma at all. What's Dharma? Going back to a real state of our mind. What's the real state of our mind? Away from all those issues that would make it not enlightened. It's very, very simple. So lineage, I find extremely important. And I like the way this gentleman, Mr. Rod Lee, had mentioned that on page 46, 47. I thought, wow, that's beautiful. And it's just it's like a quarter of a paragraph or one paragraph. It's wonderful. Now, then I like this one, page 37. I'm going over what we read. Page 37, the bottom, going beyond normality. And I tell you, that really applies in our group, going beyond normality. Look around you. Which of you is normal? Look at Tamara. Does she look normal to you? She doesn't look normal to me at all. Can we get a camera on her so they know what I'm talking about, please? Look at her. Does she look normal to you? I don't look normal either. That's why I like abnormal people. What respectable, mature lady would run around as a Cyndi Lauper reincarnation? But I love it. People like that will practice the Dharma and they will expand. They will go further. Why? They break conventions. They're ready to break conventions. They're saying, look, I want to be me. So practicing Dharma is all about being me because you go back to yourself. I like that. People like JP who act normal, look normal. We'll move along a little slower. People like Ben, he's going to be enlightened tomorrow. Okay, your guru has a command. Grow hair. Grow hair because Andy is not happy anymore. Andy wants to be the only egghead in the group. Okay, he doesn't need another egghead. Your head looks great with no hair, but you're scaring me. You're going to scare the monks. You're going to scare all the other freaks. This attractive lady behind you is going to say, I'm not doing that right now. Just kidding. And you know, if you keep your hair that short, you're going to get styes on your eye. Yeah, because, the hair's got to grow somewhere, right? You know what I'm talking about. He's sitting there with this sty like, okay. True love. I love this. I really had to go beyond my normal perception and thinking. That in itself is extremely difficult. Yet loving is beyond the normal conceptual mind anyway. True love means that whatever happens, you stay in the process and find a way through, rather than just being conditional and giving up. For example, sometimes I would do something to what I thought was the best of my ability, and rather than Rinpoche saying, that's wonderful, you've done the best you could, like I thought he should, he would tell me what was wrong with it in a rather wrathful way. So I like the first part where it says, true love means that whatever happens, you stay in the process and find a way through, rather than just being conditional and giving up. I love that. I love that because that falls along with what I just opened my talk with. If you practice Dharma, and I'm talking about real Dharma, I'm not talking about chanting mantras. I'm talking about if you practice Dharma, you have true love for others and for yourself. You have true love. Why? Love is a word, and love is nice to say, and love is nice to express, but the action of love is effort. Effort is love. Love is effort. By simply saying to a bunch of school kids, oh, I love you, you know, I love you, you're wonderful, I love you, you don't do anything for them. They're starving to death, they're not having any education, and nobody takes care of them. They're sitting on the street sniffing glue, but you say, oh, I love you, doesn't really help. You know, some of these stars I see on TV, in videos, they always tell the audience, oh, I love you. They say it over and over, I love you, I love you. Of course they love them because they're buying their ticket and they're becoming rich. I would love them too, what? But people buy your ticket, they come and see you, and then you love them. That's kind of a weird love. It's contaminated love. It's love based on you're getting something off of people. Real love is effort toward others. when we give up, when we give up, then we are being conditional. Why is it when we give up, we're being conditional? Because if this happens, if this happens, if this happens, then I will do it. If this doesn't happen, if that doesn't happen, if it's not this way, I won't do it. But if it's this way, I will do it. If it's that way, I will do it. That's not love. That's conditions. In English, it's very simple. It's called conditional. When we give up, it is a sign of true selfishness. It's a sign that we don't love others. When we have a commitment or we promise to do something and we push it away, push it, push it, push it, push it, push it, we have to be reminded and told again and again and again. And it may be difficult, and that's why we avoid it. Then we're not a person that's really loving others and loving people who we should love or repay the kindness of others. Example, our beautiful mothers. Why is that? Love must be shown in effort. In effort. If there's no effort, how can you say you love? So if we give up, and we want to cite reasons why we gave up, no matter how valid it sounds, how good it sounds why we gave up, anybody with higher wisdom and understanding will say no. You're very selfish and you're very conditional. That is why when we read biographies of people, whoever they are, who make it through thick and thin and they go through so much hardship, it touches us, the book sells. People read it, becomes a bestseller, and we really want to learn their secret, and we want to interview these people, we want to be around these people, and they inspire us. Why is that? Because we know they love so much, and they love everyone so much. That's why they achieve. They love themselves. Someone that loves themselves is not necessarily selfish. Correct love of oneself is very beneficial, and it influences many people. Correct love of oneself. Simply loving myself and being selfish to others, that's not love. I lived in America for many years, and I have people saying, I have to do what I need to do. I need my space because I need to love myself. And I think, sounds good, but there's something off there. You see, the love of ourselves cannot be at the expense of another person, another being. That's not love. And love is without conditions. So therefore, if we wish to study the Dharma, if we wish to engage in practice, if we wish to transform our mind, if we wish to apply the teachings, we have to love ourselves. How do we love ourselves? It must be expressed in effort. If during Dharma talks we can't even stay awake, we don't love anybody. We don't love ourselves, we don't love anyone. Why? We miss everything. So Dharma talks can only be at the time we can stay awake. Otherwise, we don't go to Dharma talks. Dharma talks can only be if there's air conditioning. Dharma talks can only be if there's chairs. Dharma talks will only be if I get a gift. Dharma talks will only be if it's funny. Dharma talks can only be if it's in English. Dharma talks can only be when I'm free. Dharma talks can only be when it's something I want to learn. We make all these conditions. Conditioned love is not love. Conditioned love is a cover for the selfish mind. People who give up, people who say they want to give up, people who quit, people who don't keep their commitments, or people who have to be pushed for their commitments, pushed again and again and again, they're people who don't love anyone. Therefore, they can never, ever get love themselves. And as time goes by, people will love them less and less and less and less and less. And their emotions can become very dangerous. They'll do more negative action, more childish action, more immature action to get more attention. Why? Because they can feel the love of others going down. And so they react how? The way they normally act. Selfishly, like a child, uncaring. They don't care what damage they do to other people. Why is that? Because that's the way they've been doing to lose the love in the first place. So people who lose the love of others due to their lack of effort, they themselves will act in such a way that's more and more negative, more and more selfish, more and more to get attention. Why? They can't get attention any other way. So people who give up, they can make excuses, oh, I'm busy, or I've got work commitments, or I need to go for a massage, oh, my hair's falling out, We can make all types of excuses. But ultimately, we know what it is. And when we allow ourselves to make excuses for giving up, it will start a trend. Then another thing will be given up, another thing will be given up, another thing will be given up, another thing, another thing, another thing. Pretty much we end up nowhere. So at the end of our lives, we look at ourselves, what we have achieved? Nothing. What have we gotten? Nothing. We still depend on other people. We still need other people. We're still looking at other people with our mouths open. We say in Tibetan with your mouth open waiting, like this, Ka tang ba gu de sha da. Give me. You just open your mouth. Why did they say open your mouth? Because babies sit there with their mouth open. Feed me, feed me. The mother's like, oh, can I have 5 minutes of peace? Feed me, feed me. So same thing in Tibetan, we have a saying with their mouth open, still waiting for things from other people. It's very short and sweet, but quite meaningful. So are we like that? Are we going through our lives with our mouth open? Except David, that doesn't count because the lips are heavy. But are we going through life with our mouth open? If we are, how do we expect love and to get love? How do we expect that? Love isn't you marry a wonderful lady or you marry a wonderful a man or you have a wonderful partner and they're stuck with you. You know, they're stuck. They can't leave for some karmic, horrible reason. They're stuck with you. That's not love. They're stuck with you. That's what it means. What's love? Love is effort. Love is not giving up. Love is not having to be pushed. Love is effort that comes from the inside. You know why love is that? Because you love others and people that matter so much. You don't give up. You don't give up. Therefore, in tantric commitments, when you reach a tantric level where you can get one of the Maha Anuttara Yoga Tantras, example Vajrayogini, example Hiruka or Chakrasambhara or Kala Chakra, if you can receive one of those initiations, there are certain commitments that go along with that. For example, holding one's three sets of vows, the Mahayana and the Bodhisattva vows along with the Hinayana vows. When you hold your vows and you do your daily sadhana commitments and you do your tok. Once you have those, once you take a Maha Anuttara Yoga initiation and you hold your vows, you do your sadhana, it is a transformation. It is a method for you to transform your whole reality. I read up on Tantra these past few days and increased faith was gained in me, more, even a little bit more knowledge. I don't have much, but more, it increased. And when we hold our tantra commitments, such as our tok commitments, and we do it in a group, it's very transformational. And to have any priorities or commitments more important than one's tantric practice, one's tantric vows and sadhana and tok, anything more than that, it is invalid already. Because within the Buddhistic practice, tantra commitments are the highest. That is why you learn them last. That's why Vajradhara appears to you secretly later. Shakyamuni appears first. So those of us who have tantric initiations of the tantric nature, holding our vows, doing our sadhanas, and doing our tok is of the utmost importance. If you are substituting that with any other practice, it is wrong. Wrong. If you want to add any, if you want to have any other practice that can be added to it, but the priority must be tantra. Why? Why? Some of us may say that, oh, I wasn't ready when I took it. I didn't understand. But that's not the Buddha's fault. That's your own fault. So you have to work together with it. That's what Geshe Tsurim Gyaltsen said in America. He said we should practice sutra and tantra simultaneously because life is short and too much distractions. Well, life now and life 100 years ago and 200 years ago is pretty much the same, up to about 80 years. But what he meant by that was now we have more distractions, much more distractions. So therefore, to put away our tantric commitments to the side and to substitute that with another practice, to say that that's more important, that is absolutely wrong. That is absolutely wrong. How can we go to the top of the stairs and we're about to enter the door to enlightenment and then we say, oh, no, I don't want to walk the next step. I want to go backwards and walk here again and then walk back up again. Ridiculous. If we wish to take tantric empowerments, some of us have, you have to understand, go all the way with it. Practice it all the way. Go all the way. And don't make any other priorities more important than your tantric commitments. I did that when I was in the United States. When I was in my late teens, 18, 19, 20, 21, I would work 6 days a week, well, 5.5 days a week. And then I would do, that time I did a Vajrayogini retreat. And that Vajrayogini retreat took me a year to finish 100,000, where it normally takes maybe a month, 3 weeks, 2 weeks, depending on your practice. It took me 1 year to finish that. And I had to do that every single day. And every day, the sessions were maybe 1 hour because I really was working very hard. And I also worked for the center. I lived at the center. I cleaned the meditation rooms. I put the cushions back. I washed the dishes. I did Geshe-la, my guru's laundry. I swept. I cleaned. I was happy to do it because there's no other way I can give back to the kindness of my guru. No other way. I wasn't paid for it. I was never paid for anything at the center. And so therefore, I had to take care of the center. I was honored to. And I had to clean and cook and all that. And on top of that, I had to attend the classes, which I was very happy to. And I never missed soap. Never. There were times I wanted to, but I never missed it. And if I missed it, I did it myself. I learned how to do it myself perfectly. I didn't wait for someone to teach me. I learned it myself perfectly. Why? It's not about what other people think about me. It's about my commitment with my guru and my yidam. And I would do my soap. I would do my retreats. And it took me a year to finish. Because I can just do one session a day instead of the four normal sessions. And on weekends, I spent more time, Sundays. But on Saturdays, even though it was a half day, I still did my retreat and I still had a good time. Let me make a confession here. Dear Buddha, I have sinned. I'd go out clubbing. I'm from Los Angeles, dear, not from the Himalayan backwaters of Tibet, where, you know, the only fun is counting yaks from a hill. 1, 2, 3, 4. 3,462 yaks, let's go home. This is boring. I'm from Los Angeles, dearie. Los Angeles, the modern day Sodom and Gomorrah. I don't care where you're from. Some of you guys are Europeans or whatever. You think your cities are fabulous. No, 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 no. Los Angeles, my dear. And there, you know how many clubs? And when I was a teeny bopper before 18, I go to the teeny bopper clubs, Coca-Cola and root beer. That was it. But it doesn't matter. And then when I reached 18, well, before 18, I borrowed my friend's identification. And trust me, I paid a heavy price to lie to them, to say, that's me. And I go into these clubs and have a great time. I didn't drink or do drugs or nothing like that, but everything else. But anyway, I won't tell you right now. I never took drugs. I never drink. I never smoke. I don't like it, but I also had vows. But I did everything else. I had a great time. You know, it was the Calvin Klein days where Brooke Shields would hang upside down and tell you, the only thing that would take me away from my Calvin Kleins is another pair. Hee hee. And I'm like, oh, how influential she was to all of us. And then there was, of course, Vidal Sassoon. But we didn't really wear that because that was a little girly. And of course, there was Gloria Vanderbilt. Do you remember her? Gloria Vanderbilt. Nobody wore that because nobody wanted to wear a swan. But anyways, it was the Vidal Sassoon days and Calvin Klein days. I don't know where I borrowed from my friends one of those designer jeans. And you know, when you get ready, you actually lay down flat on the ground to zip it up. I did. I lay down flat to zip it up. And someone had to help you up. It's that tight. That was the era. And let me tell you, I was a 29 waist. I'm 29 and a half now. But anyways, I was a 29 waist. 29, 34. That was my whatever. And I had a great time. So I had my friends all come over and I asked them what I would wear. And I parade in and out of my closet and try all different kinds of outfits so I look great. And then we go out partying. We have a good time. Oh, there are so many clubs happening. We go club hopping. We go to 4 or 5 clubs. I know this is a little sick. I'll be on the podium, you know, doing mantras and visualize myself as some tantric deity and dancing, having a great time. I'll bless everybody here as a fantasy. I mean, it was an invalid reason to have fun so I wouldn't feel guilty. So can you imagine I was on a podium visualizing myself as Yamataka blessing everybody here? See, it's a tantric reason I'm here. I fooled everybody but my guru. He looked at me as tantric, dearie, tantric. Geshe-la was very kind. He didn't openly say, he said, oh yes, tantric. Anyways, then I'd go home after the club. Yeah, I literally go home. 3, 4 a.m., I crawl back home and I do one session of my Vajrayogini retreat. I set up the offerings, set up the sensory offerings, the tormas, everything. And I purify the room. I slide out of my Calvin Klein's. Literally slide out. Oh, God, it was so, you know, you had to lay down and unzip it. When you took it off, you could breathe. You were like, you can literally, that's the style that time. And, dearie, I didn't have 1 ounce of fat on me at that time. Not 1 ounce. Not 1 ounce. Unlike Sing Piao, who doesn't have any fat, but I was not sporty either. He knows the meaning. So in any case, I slide out of my jeans. And then, you know, in the 80s, it was hair. It was all hair. It was all about the hair. It took me an hour to get ready for the hair. And it came out wrong. I'm not kidding. You know, you sit there and blow dry. It was very long and different colors. And you blow dry it this way, that way. And they'd be like, you look great. Like, I don't know, Duran, you know that kind of look? Or Adam Ant. It was all about the hair. So I come home, wash off all the hair products you put on there to keep it the way it looked. I mean, you look like crap, but your hair is still gray at night. And you come home, you wash all that crap out of your hair. You slide out of your jeans. And then you sit down and you try not to think about all the fun you had. And sometimes, you're able to focus and then I do my retreat. What am I trying to tell you? I'm the same as all of you. Exactly the same. I want to have a good time too. I have plenty of good times. And I did all the stuff that you guys did, probably more than some of you. Definitely more than Chao. Chao's still a rah-rah. Yes, Chao's still a rah-rah. It starts with a V. And that's Chao. Just in case, yes, he's still a rah-rah. You can translate in French. I said, wah, wah, wah. I don't know. Believe me, it's true. She's like, this is 2000, what is it? 8, 7, oh, 7. I forgot what year it is. Isn't that ridiculous? Yeah, he's still on wrong. I don't dare say that nasty V word because we're in Malaysia. But anyway, my point is what? Is I had a great time, but I still did my retreats. I still attended TOP. I still worked. And I finished my retreat. It took me 1 year. Let me tell you, towards 6 or 7 months, I was like screaming. I was like, oh God, I wish I can finish. I wish I can finish. You know why? Let me tell you about those retreats. You have to do the practice exactly in the same seat that you started. You can't move the seat. You can't move to another area. And there are certain tormas that you need to put. For this practice, you can't even move the tormas. The tormas has to stay exactly. So when you clean, you got to clean around it. So your seat and your tormas have to be exactly the same. You can't move. And you have to do your practice on that seat. There's a reason for it. So you have to keep coming back. I can't do my practice. Sometimes we went to Long Beach, or sometimes we drove away to San Fernando Valley, or we drove away to Orange County or wherever. There's 2-3 hours drive away with friends to go partying or funny or whatever, have fun or whatever. And I would have to drive back. I didn't have money for taxis. I had to drive back or take a rotten bus, 4 or 5 buses back, transfer, to come and do my retreat. And I had to do it on that seat. It took me a year. And sometimes I would resent it. Sometimes I'd go, oh God. You know, look at Vajragini, you want to take her neck. Yeah, I would think like that. I mean, I have just evil mind, just as anybody else. I want to strangle her. I was like, why so many rules? Why don't you make it easy? I thought you were a Buddha. And suddenly you'd be really happy. Anyway, I finished. I come back and do it. And you have to do one session before you fall asleep. You can do it two ways, either before 12, but I debated with my guru. I said, there's no clocks in Tibet. How do you know it's 12 o'clock? He said, oh yeah, don't ask me all kinds of stupid questions. Before you sleep. Did you have clocks in Tibet? It was my big issue. So I would do it before I slept. So sometimes before 6 a.m., before 7 a.m., sometimes before 9 a.m. because I crawled back home Sunday morning at 7 a.m. But I would do it. And that's how I did my Tara Chitamani retreat. That's how I did my Avalokiteshvara retreats. And I did the fire pujas with my teacher. The pressure was very great because sometimes Geshe-la would put actually a timing on when we would do the fire puja. The fire puja is the conclusion of the retreat, an offering, a celebration. Conclusion. And Geshe-la was very, very harsh to me. Now I know why, when I missed Tok. Very, very harsh. I don't have the right to be harsh to anyone, and no one here has the right to be harsh to anyone. But we have to be careful with ourselves. But I have tremendous faith in my guru. So if he's harsh to me, it's a blessing. I don't lose confidence and faith. These days, if the guru gives you a slight wrathful look, the guru gets a slap. You mean you're not attending Tok? No, and what are you going to do about it? Oops. Sorry, you're holding. Oh, you dare not. These days, gurus get slapped and shouted at. And did you hear about the guru counseling sessions they have these days? They go to psychologists. Hi, my name is Temramji and I'm a guru. And I have to go for counseling because I have these fears of being slapped and abused by students. It's very different than before. Very, very different. These days, you know Milarepa and Marpa? You know what Milarepa went through with Marpa? If Marpa was around today, he'd be arrested. He'd be arrested and put away for counseling and probably, you know, stay in jail for many years. And then he would tell the court judge, you know, but I'm trying to purify my students so he can be a Buddha. Yeah, yeah, right, right. That's it. They throw away the key. Imagine if Marpa was around today. How about Tilopa and Naropa? You guys should know about that. If Naropa was around, Tilopa was around, Tilopa, Naropa would be going for counseling. Tilopa would be in jail with Marpa. How are you? What'd you do? Think about it. So these days, if gurus dare tell students off or mention that they might be wrong, that's a biggie. What do you mean I'm wrong? I have my opinions too. And you dare not. So these days, gurus have to actually walk on glass when they teach the Dharma. You know Annie Lennox's song, Walk on Glass? That's right. So what's very important is this is commitment, holding our commitment. And the ability to hold our commitment comes from knowledge and understanding of what we have. Attending Dharma talks and reading and contemplation will definitely give us knowledge of what we have. And holding our commitments, the actual act of holding our commitments and keeping them, our promises, our samayas, and which is by effort, is pure love. If you do your tok commitments, if you do your sadhana, if you do your practice in sadhanas, if you have guru devotion, it is love of what? Love of all sentient beings. Why is that? You wish, dichirdu, for this reason I wish to become a fully enlightened being, therefore I will engage in this practice. If you read any higher tantric practices, the first line is visualization, refuge, after that is generation of the body-mind. Any sadhana, any tradition, definitely. So therefore, if that's so important, if we keep our commitments in sadhana, our practices, if we keep that, it is definitely love. What kind of love? Love of all sentient beings. That means you have reached that level to practice tantra. If you say, I haven't reached that level, I'm not going to do it, you already got initiation. So you need to continue. You can't just say, oh, hi, Vajragini, I love you, but I'm not ready for you. See you later. Put it in a closet with the rest of yourself. You can't. And some of us, I tell you, you need to come out. That's right. I won't point any fingers because I don't have that many fingers to point tonight with so many of you. That's right. But it's okay. If I have to, I'll open that closet and scream Dharma down the closet. Hello! Come on out! That's right. JP's innocently sitting there pretending he doesn't know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're asking for it, JP. You're asking for it. You're begging for it. Begging. Look at him. Now he's excited. Now he's pretending he's not excited. Can you understand me? Am I talking too fast? Good. And even if you don't, too bad. No, I'm just kidding. She's wonderful, isn't she? Is your leg okay? You sure? Do you need to stand up for a minute? You don't, huh? But we will, so you keep sitting. No, I'm just kidding. Now, commitment is love. Keeping effort is love. Not having effort and giving up and breaking commitment and breaking our promises to other people, whether it's high or low, is not love. It means we don't love ourselves and love others. I've explained to you why. This book's explaining to you why. This book is not about guru devotion. This book is about finding the guru within yourself. When I read this, it's not about some weird Eastern practice of devoting yourself to some weird Eastern guy from Tibet. No, I don't find that at all. If you read in between the lines and deeper, these beautiful people have wonderful experiences. And I see them as who they are, as they are, but they're mind transforming. I don't see anybody here saying, oh, I have to be Tibetan, I have to drink this, I have to eat this, I have to do this. Nothing. I see them being who they are. And that's a good trend. So I want to emphasize that this book is about effort. In the beginning, we might need a teacher to explain to us why effort is love. And love is effort. But if we are listening to this teaching and we are in our mind, we are agreeing to it, that means we are tapping into the true source of our mind. Why? You can't agree to anything you don't know. You can't agree to anything that's not the truth. And what is true is already inherent in you, according to Lord Buddha. Already inherent in you. So a teacher helps us to find the teacher within us in the beginning. To look for a teacher without a teacher in the beginning is pretty hard. That's like saying I want to be an engineer, but I don't need a teacher, a university, or books. I'm going to go under a tree and meditate. Pretty impossible. Pretty impossible, even for worldly knowledge. Now, lineage, very important. In these five chapters, very, very important. Two is effort. Effort is very important. Not to give up. Not to give up on yourself, not to give up on others. Very, very important. To keep our promises, to keep our commitments, to say, to do what we're going to say, to do what we have said. Why is that important? In normal life, that's important. In spiritual practice, it's even more important. Why? You're making solemn vows to the enlightened beings. Example, when you take refuge. So, then here. It says on page 16 by this wonderful lady, Christine. Page 16 in the first paragraph. I would give him the support he needed with all my love. Just the day before, we had asked each other forgiveness for the difficulties we had had that year. We had also expressed our gratitude for the precious time we had shared, for all we had learned and come to trust about love, and we said our goodbyes. Now, when he was actually dying, I knew that fully letting him go with all my love was the last gift I could give him, and there was a deep peace in my heart. But I also knew as he lay dying that one day I was going to die. Before that happened, I decided that I wanted to have a much deeper understanding of death and clarity about how to spiritually prepare for my death. I find that very, very beautiful, and I find that very wonderful, but I want us to go one step further. Why find peace in your heart by expressing love to someone, unconditional care to someone, forgiving and asking for forgiveness when you're dying? Why don't we do that right now? That's what I don't understand. This is all very beautiful, but why live peace, forgiveness, unconditional love when we are dying or when we're about to die and we have no choice? Why don't we do that right now? If that has such an effect on our mind and how we go while we're dying, to forgive and to express love and to thank others, to give gratitude to others, if it's so important at the time that we're dying so that our mind be calm and easy, why? In the death and dying process, it is very important as an environmental condition that our minds are calm and the environment around us is calm, so that it does not alert the mind in any way that triggers any type of negative karma. Example, if we run to a dying person who's very attached to money and say, oh, guess what? I know you hate me, but when you die, I've manipulated all the paperwork that I get all your money. It's going to disturb them. That's an environmental condition to make them very worried. And then this thought of money, all my hard work, and it's mine, and you're going to get it, all arises. It all arises, and it triggers all the karma that came in that person's life from being miserly, for chasing after money, and using money, and using that as a weapon. And all the fear that came along with that money will be triggered a whole lifetime. And therefore, what happens? They leave their state of mind they leave their body in a state of mind of avarice, greed, fear. That will trigger the further karma that they have stored in their mind for many lifetimes to take a new rebirth, that they will suffer from difficulties of money, or they might be born into money and suffer from the problems of having money. So he's saying, well, what's the difference? They already have that karma. There is a difference. Why? When the person is dying, even though they've been very greedy or avaricious or miserly in their whole life, we still don't wish them something bad. So when they're dying, instead of worrying them, We don't talk about things that raise money into their mind. We don't talk about it. So what happens? That karma stays dormant. That karma stays quiet so that person can take another rebirth, hopefully, and practice. So by practicing, that karma can surface in a conditioned environment where it doesn't have such a powerful effect, or it becomes purified. Example, if you have the karma to get a coat, a very nice coat, and you reincarnate in Alaska, it's going to be very, very helpful. But if you have the karma to have that coat and you reincarnate in the Sahara Desert and you have to wear it, it's going to be suffering. So having the karma to have something also is dependent on environment. So therefore, when you're dying, you need to keep the person's mind still and quiet. Why? To help them that the negative karma doesn't surface. And the positive karma surfaces. That doesn't mean the negative karma doesn't exist. It does exist, but not to make it open. Example, we all have viruses all over our body. But the minute the immune system comes down, it blows up. It blows up immediately. We get a sty. We get warts. We get flus, etc., etc. It just comes up. But if we sleep right, and we eat well, and we exercise, and we maintain ourselves well, the viruses cannot open up, or very few and in between. Similarly, karma is like a virus. It will open up. It will definitely open up. It's always with us. So like that, it's very important to keep the mind of the person calm and quiet and happy. That is why in hospice practice, that is why in the care of the death, the dying, and the ones who are going to die very soon, it is very important to keep their mind still, keep their mind happy, and say things that make their mind very calm and quiet and happy. That is according to the Buddhist view of reincarnation and karma. But in normal means, if you don't believe that, by keeping the person's mind happy while they're dying, it's still a very beautiful experience for the giver and the receiver. Who wants to die with getting a slap? I hate you. You're horrible. You hurt me. Slap, 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 slap. Who wants to die like that? So like that, my thing is, why don't we go one step further? What happens if the person that we have hurt is not around for us to ask forgiveness? What happens if the people that are kind to us are not around for us to express our gratitude? What happens if the people that we have had some open karma or sore karma with is not around for us to make peace? Then what happens? So why wait for the time of death to say, I'm sorry? Why wait for your dying time to say thank you? Why wait for the time when you're dying to think, I should have my mind like that, I should think like this, I should be good like that, I should let go, it doesn't matter anymore. Why wait for that? If it's beneficial when we're dying, wouldn't it be more beneficial if we had that state of mind while we're living? Actually, none of us are living, all of us are in a state of dying. We're going closer to dying. Why do we keep talking about this? Because by talking about this, we will be able to live well. How do we live well? How? By talking about death and meditating upon death and focusing on that reality, it makes us forgive. It makes us let go. It makes us realize that this doesn't matter anymore. It means that people have hurt us doesn't matter anymore. We don't need to hurt anymore. We don't need to give hurt. And we need to say thank you. And we need to apply ourselves for the time we have left. Why? Because if we're dying, that's what matters. Is to have a happy state of mind and create happiness around us. How can we have a happy state of mind while we're dying? How? By creating happiness around us. And to make peace with the people that we don't have peace with. So we live a life of using people. Breaking promises. Lying, fooling, parasiting, fighting, arguing, wanting to win, justifying, covering. If we live a life of that, and at the time of death, how sincere will our I'm sorry or I thank you be? And even if it is sincere, think about it this way. How many years of it you've been living? And that last statement at the time of death, do you think that can override all the many years that you've been living opposite of what you've been saying? I'm sorry, Rinpoche, for not doing my commitments and practice. Of course, Rinpoche say fine. Unless he's Tem Rinpoche, he'll say, aha, see you in hell. Only Tem Rinpoche would tell you, see you in hell. Because that's where Tem Rinpoche is probably going. But a real Rinpoche will say, oh no, it's okay, I forgive you. It's all right, never mind. But you see, it's not about him forgiving or not forgiving. If you pray to Mother Tara and say, forgive me, I received your initiation, I haven't been doing talk because I've been a lazy monster, and I've made other commitments more stronger than your commitment. And then you say, I'm sorry, Tara. Of course Tara say it's all right. She's so fabulous. She's not green with envy. She's green from compassion. Why is she green from compassion? Compassion expressed in the air element, meaning quickness and of giving siddhis and quickness to help. Quickness to help and quickness to assist others. That quickness is associated with wind energy. Wind energy in psychotherapy color is green. Therefore, Mother Tara is green. Very simple. So her green comes from enlightenment and love, not greed and envy. So if we say, I'm sorry to Mother Tara, I'm sorry I haven't been doing your talk or whatever, blah, blah, blah. I haven't been doing your sadhana because I've been too into myself. Of course she forgives you, but all the years you've broken your commitment, that karma will catch up. So my point is, why wait for near death or death to say I'm sorry or to make an effort or to say thank you or to make peace? Why? How many years of the karma we've collected? How much pain we have created in other people? And maybe there are people out there that have helped us so much and we didn't even say thank you, or people have to tell us, don't forget to say thank you, and then we thank them. And then we don't express our gratitude. How many years of that has that been? A cold, oh, thank you very much for helping me, or a cheap little SMS, thank you for helping me, is not the point. Thank you to the person for helping you means you have some result of their help. When you have result of their help, you produce greater and greater and greater results. Example, if someone helped you to do retreat, you don't thank them by failing your retreat and quitting and not finishing and not doing it and forgetting about it. You thank them by finishing the retreat. And then when you finish the retreat, you go to them and say, thank you for your help. Then it really is real thank you. But to say thank you and not have results is a mind game. So if you say to your mother, oh mother, thank you very much for keeping me in your womb for 9 months. Thank you so much for giving me birth. Thank you for taking care of me and putting me through school, washing my snots and my crap and changing my diapers. Thank you for giving me money and food and your love and your wisdom and care. There is no one greater on this planet than my mother. And then you turn out to be a convict in jail because you raped 20 women and you've been robbing liquor stores. What kind of thank you is that to your mother? You think your mother be, oh, you're welcome. She's like, what is he talking about? He's a freak. How do you thank your mother by being in jail? Then if you say, oh, I love my mother. She's the most wonderful. Because I hear that all the time here. Many people respect their mother. Many people. I hear that all the time. My mother is great. Even some people drop a tear or two when we talk about their mother. But how do you repay your mother's kindness? By forgetting? By not being successful? By being kicked out of your job? By not being able to pay your rent? By not being able to keep up your payment? By not being a human being? By not being an adult? By always forgetting and forgetting? That's how you thank your mother? Oh, mommy, thank you. Your mother is doing this when you're thanking her. Because her eyes rolls up and she's trying to roll it down. She's like, oh, God. Think about it. How do we thank our mother? Thank you is not a word. Thank you is not an SMS. Thank you is not 8 letters. Thank you is you have to be something from that help. So if someone helps you in business, you have to have the results. I mean, of course, people can fail through even with effort. If people help you in retreat, you have to have some result. After retreat, you have to be kinder, more nicer, more calm, more forgiving. After retreat, you go and become a serial killer. Then you say, oh, thank you for the retreat. They say, oh, no, I'm not going to sponsor anybody again. Think about it. After retreat, you're Jack the Ripper's reincarnation. You found out during Buddha told you. That person say, I'm never going to sponsor anybody in retreat again. Never. So how do you thank people? What is this book telling you to find the guru in you? Guru devotion is not about kissing some Tibetan guy's feet. Mwah, you're my guru. It's not about that. It's not about some Tibetan guy telling you things and you say, you're right because you're the guru and I'm one with you. I don't want to be one with some of you. Do you think I want to be one with his sty? Kendra Rowe, do you think he wants to be one with me? No. I don't want Kendra Rohit to visualize me and I'm dissolving into him and I'm one with him and he's smiling blissfully in fourth heaven. No, thank you. I wouldn't. Would you want to be one with me? Imagine me. Imagine JT here. This nice lady sitting over here. Imagine she dissolves me into her. I won't even fit. How to fit? How about Wendy over there? Look how nice and pretty she is. Somebody point to Wendy. Yeah, she's about 3'1". Now the only person that dissolves me into them and I can be one with them that I might fit is maybe Koki and Tamara. Vajra Satwa Hong. And David's lips, I forgot. David dissolves me and says, Liz. And I'm like, there's still plenty of room. Come on in, guru, lineage gurus. All the lineage gurus can fit in that. What? That's not what guru devotion is about. It's not about this. You don't just read the surface. That's why we need to read it, and I want to talk about it. I want to talk about guru devotion with all of you. I want to talk about what it's about and why and how it inspires these people, because these are great practitioners. These are non-Tibetan great practitioners who've taken Dharma into their lives, not changed their lives for Tibetan culture or something. You know, they run around with yak skins. They do Lama Cham dances. And they hang it out in distant parts of Nepal pretending they're holy by helping schools. Don't point at her. Some of you think, who's that? Who goes to Nepal and helps the school? Who are? Madams are there thinking, I'd like to go and teach English. So that's not about that. But when you thank a person, thank you so much for your financial help. Thank you so much for your care and your effort. You have to show some result. You can't keep calling these people every week to talk about your problems and you never improve. And then you still say thank you. After that, thank you will become like a curse. They're like, oh no, he's going to thank me. Oh, oof. No. Then if you say, I'm sorry to someone, I'm sorry for disappointing you. I'm sorry for being a loser. I'm sorry for forgetting. I'm sorry for doing damage. I'm sorry for fighting with you. I'm sorry for throwing the coffee cup across the room. I'm sorry. And next week you throw the teacup across the room. What's the difference? I'm sorry has no more effect. And if you give a lifetime of I'm sorry, that's fake, and you give a lifetime of thank yous that are based on no result, at the time of death when you say thank you and I'm sorry also, there will be no peace. No peace in other people's minds and no peace in your mind. And who will receive the result is yourself. Is yourself. So therefore, my point is, this teaching that Christine gave us is wonderful in this book. Wonderful. Why is she wonderful? She lets us go to the next step. And that is, don't wait for death. Don't wait when you're dying. Don't wait when your body's being taken over by something. It will be eventually, I'm sorry to say. It will be to say I'm sorry or to thank someone. We need to do it now. And if we're going to do it now, if we're going to thank someone or say I'm sorry, we got to mean it. And how do we mean it? We got to make an effort. How do we make an effort? We got to push ourselves. We've got to push ourselves. Now, we got to make an effort. We got to stop sitting there with our mouth open. Stop. We got to stop waiting for people to do things for us. We got to stop justifying our minds and its habituations and the harm it brings to other people sometimes. We have to stop. Why do we have to stop? Because does it really matter in the end? Who wins or who loses? How much money you have or don't have? Does it really matter in the end? So therefore, we need to say I'm sorry now. And we need to say thank you to people now. And we need to back that thank you up by genuinely thinking about the compassion of others. In the beginning, when we're young, when we're born and we're young, we depend on other people's kindness, namely our parents, our mothers, to grow, to be nurtured, to be taken care of. In the end, we depend on other people's kindness when we're old and we're decrepit and we're dying. So doesn't it behoove us that in the middle, we are kind to others? His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama. Isn't it very important? So therefore, a very good motivation to transform our minds is to come to terms with everybody around us now, to be very forgiving of people. Very forgiving. No matter how much damage they do to you, no matter how much they have cheated you in your perception, no matter how much hurt you have received, no matter if it's hurt from 100 people or 200 or 1 or 20, to forgive, to let go. Why is it important? We can die tonight. So at the time of death, we have to let go. We can't go with that state of mind. It affects us very badly. So why wait for that time when we're out of fear? We feel like that. We should do it now while we have the freedom. Why? While we have the freedom to do it, we do it every single day until death comes. And then attainments arise. Then something positive arises. Don't wait for death. Don't wait. For some of us in this room, it's within 10 years. For some of us in this room, it's within 5. For some of us in this room, it's within 20. But definitely within 40 years. No, definitely within 50 years, everybody in this room will be dead. Within 50 years. Within, not after, not exactly. Within 50 years, every single person in this room right now will be dead. No one will remember us anymore. No one will understand. And our fears, our happiness, our attachments doesn't matter anymore. We will be in another body, another plane, another place, taking the karma we've collected with us. Within 50 years, all of us will be dead in this room. You go home and meditate on that. You meditate in what way? That it provokes you to transform. It provokes you to enter the spiritual path. It provokes you to do something more with your precious human body. Doesn't matter if you're male or female. Doesn't matter. In fact, there are some schools of thought that females can attain higher spiritual evolvement faster because they have a natural, caring, giving kind of energy. In some schools of thought, doesn't really matter. As long as you have a human body, the end. So therefore, if within 50 years everybody here is going to be dead, what's important right now? What is important right now? You see, some of us feel a little uncomfortable. Some of us feel a little nervous and scared. Transform that. Use that fear and that worry into doing something more, to pushing yourself more, to applying more effort. That's what it's for. That's what it's for. Then you'll be living. So therefore, we should apply effort now. We should hold our commitments now. We should study the Dharma now. And when we study the Dharma, don't let it be intellectual and dry. Apply it to everybody around us. Forgive everyone that has harmed you. Everyone, forgive, let go. I'll tell you why. Maybe they don't deserve to be forgiven, we may think. But we deserve to forgive them because we need to take a good rebirth. We need to have a beautiful life and a good death. We deserve that. So we deserve to forgive. Don't think about the other person. It's not about them anymore. It's about yourself. We deserve to forgive them. We deserve to have a higher mind. We deserve to be evolved. We deserve to become a Buddha. So we definitely should forgive them, whether they deserve it or not. We deserve it. We deserve that good rebirth. We deserve that clarity of the mind. We deserve to have openness and clear, calm, quiet, easy, released, free mind. We deserve that. That's why we need to forgive others. If we love every single sentient being on this planet, But there's one person that bothers us. I guarantee you that one person will override everybody that we love. We have experienced that. I've experienced people that really bug me, and it ruins my whole day. And there can be wonderful people coming, oh, Rimitri, you're fabulous. Give me gifts. Give me money. Give me clothes. Give me furs. Give me cars. I want more. Give me jewelry, diamonds. They give me all these things, and I like it, and I put it away for when I'm happy, but right now I'm not happy with it. Oh, yeah, I store it away. I store it away when I'm happy. I take over and I say, oh, I'm very happy. Thank you. And I write thank you cards. But at that moment, I'm not happy because someone disturbed my mind. I experienced that. You can ask some of my liaisons when I throw my BFs. When I throw my BFs, I mean, it's all censored. You know, nobody's supposed to know that Rimichi throws BFs and he changes his mind. What are you smiling at, Tiki? Nobody's supposed to know that Rinpoche's an ordinary person. He throws BFs. He has temper tantrums. He's got his moods. He gets depressed. He needs Xanax. Nobody's supposed to know that. Everybody's supposed to think that Rinpoche's an enlightened being. Keep thinking that. It's good for business. Keep thinking that. But yeah, I go through the same thing. And you know what I find? I'm teaching I'm sharing with you. I dare not say teach. I'm sharing with you what I've experienced when I apply the teachings. And what is that? It's easier to forgive. If there's one person that really, really, really bugs you, really, they really, you, I tell you. Oh, if there was no karma just for 1 week, things I can do, I tell you. Just 1 week, no karma. You can do what you want. Get whoever you want back, I tell you. Ooh, I'm going to need about a month. There's some people, plural, that, ooh. And that ruined everybody else because I have a whole bunch of other friends that adore me, that think I'm enlightened, that I think I'm a high lama, and they prostrate to me, and then whatever I say, oh, Rimiji, you're fabulous. There's so many more people who think that except JP, so many more. And there's only one or two who disturb me and ruffle my feathers because I allow them to. And they disturb my equilibrium for everything else that day with everyone else. You check it out with yourselves. Doesn't that happen? When someone pisses you off, you get up, you have a bad morning, the whole day is bad. Why is the whole day bad? Because you let that win. So, similarly, over the years, I've learned to let go of this very fast. These days, just a few hours, when I get really pissed off, when I really, really get on my nerves, I tell you, it's just for a few hours now. And that's amazing. For those of you who know me more than 10 years, it can go on for months. Yeah, I think I'm a reincarnation of a snake or something. I am a snake. Anyway, I'm a wood snake. But anyways, it can go on for months. When I was in America, when anybody wronged me, it would go on for months. They wouldn't see my tight, beautiful jeans and my beautiful long legs and fabulous bubble butt for months. I had a bubble butt. Not a J-Lo butt. J-Lo, a bubble butt. That's side view, you know, like that. I had one. And I still do, but you can't see it under all these robes. And when I walked, it moved. Not a lot, just a little, because if it moved too much, it's kind of girly, you know. Not too much. No, it wasn't like JP's butt, you know. When JP walks, I'm... You're nearby, knocks you over. And that's right. But I had a nice butt. It moved just a little. Oh, wait. Where was I? Okay, sorry. We're in a Dharma teaching. I'm a Rinpoche, Dharma, Buddha. Okay. I got to focus myself. See, I get carried away too. Anyway, these days, no kidding. Last time, it could be months. Not years, though. Months. And, you know, a few years back, it become weeks and days. These days, I promise you, Buddha scouts honor. No kidding. When I get really pissed off or someone really gets on my nerves and I really... It's just for a few hours. And do you know, that's not for all cases. It's for about 80 or 90% of the 70 or 80% of the cases now where people get on my nerves for a few hours. I'm really irritated. I really, you know, I don't have anything left in my house to throw, but if I had, I would. And let me tell you, for many cases now, it's just a few minutes. I'm amazed at myself. Sometimes I'm amazed. Sometimes I'm angry that I'm not angry anymore. I think, what? I'm going to let that person win. I really think that. I'm going to let that person win if I'm not angry with them anymore and I don't punish them by not talking with them or something like that. It doesn't have a hold on me so strong anymore. And I know that this year and next year, if I live that long, I know it's going to get better. I know I will reach a state in my mind that I don't have any angry thoughts to people or reaction to angry thoughts. More reaction anymore. Angry thoughts, I think it'll take a while, but reaction, where it just go away instantly. I know I'll achieve that because that's what I'm pushing for. So my point to you is, I'm far away from attainments and Buddha, but I'm getting closer to becoming a very wonderful person. Getting much closer. Much, much closer. Where people don't really bother me anymore. But then was it really people or me? I'm not sure, but never mind. And that I'm reaching a state now. Listen to this. I've amazed myself. That even people who've disappointed me and hurt me or harmed me or lied to me, I can even help them back. Give them advice, give them money, give them things that they need. I can even give these things back to them and not expect anything back. I can do that now. See, it's not the same as giving food to the homeless, because our group has the honor to give food to the homeless in Kuala Lumpur. We do that every Saturday. It's not the same as giving to the homeless. Homeless are neutral. Giving help to people that have hurt you, or you think they have hurt you, is very profound practice. And I'm trying to do that profound practice. Why, if I'm doing my sadhanas, if I'm doing my mantras, if I'm doing my studies and meditations, that must be the result, right? The result must be I can do that. What other result do we want from meditation? What other result do we want from doing soak and offerings? That we know the mudras well? We sit in puja. Oh, nice mudra. Oh, oops, I'm in soak. What other reason are we in Tok to do mudras well? And some of us in Tok, you know, we're actually in deep tantric meditation. And some of us in Tok, we express our spirituality in. Oh, some of us in Tok, you know, we can ring that Dharma rod. I tell you, we can ring it. We practice it at home. We don't care about the meditation. We don't care about bodhicitta. We don't care about love. We don't care about compassion. We don't care about sentient beings. We can ring that Dhamma bell. Oops. Yeah. So our Tok practice is like that. You know, we're in Tok. We're doing the ritual. What a teeny little mantra. We're in Tok, you know, and we're doing a great job because we practice at home. We practice this weeks after weeks so that when everybody's watching us, it's like an opera performance. That's very good because that's the result of our practice. Broken. So some of us are very good in soak. And we're like, and then we need to chant this way or we need to chant that way. And if we don't chant that way, we're not allowed to argue doing soak. So we argue with our mind. Oh, you just wait till after it's soak. You just wait till after it's soak. And some people are not even that advanced. They don't even practice. They sit there like, when the guy next door is doing it, they're like, Oh, stop. Haven't you seen them in Tok practice? It's so ridiculous. Tok is not about that. It's about transformation. This is just an expression of it. It's just an expression.